You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. The past 18 months have been a political whirlwind in both the UK and the USA. Britain's departure from the European Union presents the opportunity for a free trade deal to be forged between the two countries. But will the opportunity be seized upon in a timely manner, or at all? Today, the IEA's Director General Mark Littlewood speaks to Michael Carnuccio, President and CEO of the E Foundation for Oklahoma, a think tank aiming to grow Oklahoma State's prosperity in the long term. Mark and Michael discuss the prospects of a free trade deal between Oklahoma State and the United Kingdom directly, focusing on what such an arrangement would look like and what it could mean for the development of other agreements between the states and the UK post-Brexit. Michael also gives an update of the politics overseas, his assessment of President Donald Trump so far, and his predictions for the November midterm elections. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Well, I'm joined by my good friend Michael Carnuccio, all the way from the great state of Oklahoma. Welcome to sunny London, Michael. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
The boot's on the other foot this time round. It was a few months ago, back in February, where you interviewed me when I was in Oklahoma City for OK Roast, and we're now interviewing you for the IEA podcast channel live from Lord North Street. What are you doing here in London?
Well, we're here to follow up on a conversation that you and I started on the other side of the pond, and that is to take the next steps toward, hopefully, a free trade agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom, but specifically focused on Oklahoma for right now and what we have to offer the United Kingdom and what we would like to receive from the United Kingdom, and hopefully we can take next steps quickly.
Tell us a little. We'll get into Brexit and free trade and Trump in just a minute, but tell us a little about the E Foundation for Oklahoma, Mike.
Sure. The E Foundation was developed from an idea with Oklahoma's Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb and myself when I was serving as president of the state's free market think tank, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs. And it was basically we recognized that a lot of the public policy that was happening in our state was operating on 1 year, kind of looking out 12 months, 13 months. And we decided we need to have a much longer, you know, any family, any business, they have a much longer strategic plan they operate under. They manage their budget and everything, thinking more longer term. And so our state needed to do that as well. So we got leaders around the state together and put together an effort focused on free enterprise and economic growth for the state.
We've been discussing, as you said, back in February when I was over in Oklahoma, prospects for free trade. And
absolutely.
This is the... I think the exciting opportunity that Brexit opens up, that we can start to strike deals and have more frictionless relationships with our allies on the other side of the Atlantic. So I'm just going to tell our listeners a little bit about Oklahoma. You'll be able to correct me, Mike, if I get any of these stats wrong. Population about 4 million, GDP about $180 billion. Sectors of note, finance, oil and gas, agriculture. 49% of Oklahoma's exports go to countries with a free trade agreement, not one that we obviously have with the United States as of yet. And the UK is the eighth largest export destination for Oklahoma. So what in your mind could Oklahoma get out of this? We're leaving the European Union, so the apple cart has been knocked over, all the cards are in the air. Tell me what the brighter future is for the UK and Oklahoma having a more intimate relationship than we've had to date.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think first, let's just talk about the principled position. I mean, for anyone who believes in free enterprise and aspires to see individuals empowered and unleashed in terms of liberty, you look at the situation that you all have right now in the UK and you say, why are you talking about the glass being half empty? Your glass is running over how full it is, and the opportunity that you have the first time in the modern age to be able to control your own destiny and take back and consider sovereignty once again. That's extremely exciting, and a lot of us don't get close to that, right? But in terms of Oklahoma specifically, we're between 3.7 and 4 million people, as you said. We don't have enough people in Oklahoma to consume everything that we're trying to produce, manufacture, grow, whatnot. But at the same time, we cannot produce, manufacture, and grow everything that we're trying to consume. So we desire trade partnerships and relationships, not just regionally, but around the globe. And look, the way the United States works, I mean, the way capitalism happens is it is a race. So we are racing against 49 other states right now, trying to make sure that not only we get to the head of the line, but we can strike the best deal and maintain our position. So that's why we're very aggressive in nature, and that's why we came here so quickly after you were in Oklahoma.
So you see that Oklahoma could be the sort of the pioneer state for pushing for free trade with the United Kingdom.
Certainly. I mean, just in this conversation, we've discussed how our state's population is smaller than your capital city here, right? We've already discussed about how the leading executive for our state is part of this foundation working on this plan. You can move much quicker. It's kind of this concept of the MVP, right? Where we can test something, we can move quicker, we can get something done to prove concept that then can spread like wildfire throughout the rest of the country. And quite frankly, kind of chart a new course through the rest of the world and the Commonwealth that you all have the opportunity.
So when I was in the USA in February and I visited various states, not just Oklahoma, and I was trying to drum up American interest in free trade deal with the United Kingdom to drop not just the tariff barriers, but some of the regulatory barriers, that meaning that we're not doing as much trade as we would if we had a proper open market. Tell us a little bit about what you think the appetite genuinely is in the USA. Are Americans seeing this as a great opportunity to rebuild the special relationship? Are they ignoring it? Are they sitting and waiting? What's the feeling and the sense of this potential opportunity on the other side of the Atlantic?
Appetite is certainly there, but I would describe it as you're really hungry at supper time, but the restaurant you really want to go to, you don't know if they're open or not. Mm-hmm. So the question that you have in the United States right now is, we're hungry, we're ready for business. Is the UK open for business? And are they interested in having us come and eat at the restaurant, I guess, to figure out the rest of the analogy there? And so I think to varying degrees, right, some of the states that you visited and talked to, there was high interest, but they're much larger, they're much more bureaucratic. It's going to take them a little bit of time. And the way that they will pick up steam, because this is the way it works in the United States, is when some of the smaller markets, either municipalities or states, start moving on things and going, that's going to create that pressure and move forward. But you're not running into any walls. I mean, there's no one over in the United States that's saying, you know, fifth largest country in the world, like what is the expression you and I use all the time that Sir Winston said at one time, we're two countries separated by the same language.
Yeah, sure.
And so there are so many similarities. I mean, we see ourselves more as brothers and sisters, if not cousins for sure, that why wouldn't we and why can't we? And for many in the United States, I mean, we have stories specifically in Oklahoma where we've had entrepreneurs that have tried to do business in the UK and have been thwarted because of Brussels, right? And mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. Now's an opportunity to see that follow through.
And you're saying that if some of the smaller states, a state like Oklahoma, starts to beat the drum for this, that word will spread to other states and that's the way to put pressure on Washington. I mean, it's not to say that the Trump administration is in any way hostile to this. All of the signaling has been that the president would be keen on a free trade arrangement as well. But you think to get it over the line, it needs to be a sort of bottom-up approach, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The way that public policy moves in the United States and public policy change happens is it's a grassroots and a groundswell up that influences Congress. And my good friend and travel partner, Tucker Link, has made the point wisely that you have 100 senators, 37 states that claim to be agricultural states. So that's 74 senators off the bat, three-fourths of the U.S. Senate. That is very passionate about this particular issue. And when it bubbles up from their state, it moves them and all of a sudden Washington tips. You don't go through Washington and go through the embedded bureaucratic culture and get something that is then passed down. In fact, when you try to do that, that's what creates the condition that Donald Trump was able to tap into and why he's in the Oval Office right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's interesting. So I wanted to move on to that. A good number of people have drawn parallels between the sort of political earthquake that elected Donald Trump, who, you know, was always seen as an unbelievable long shot who was going to come unstuck long before the primary process ended and certainly was going to come unstuck against Hillary. He made it, and it was a sort of backlash against the political machine. And a lot of people think that's similar to what happened with Brexit here, that it was outside the beltway, ordinary people kicking back against the political establishment. What do you think of those analogies?
Yeah, I think they're almost identical. I mean, extremely similar. A couple of the outlying factors that with Donald Trump, one is in the United States presidency has very much become a popularity contest, and he had the celebrity status that was there. He was facing somewhat celebrity status in the Clinton family, but the Clintons and Bushes, we had such a dynasty that was happening, and that fed into this narrative that you had the working class and the kind of blue-collar, somewhat undereducated population who typically had not been voting. In fact, the demographic of white, undereducated males started dropping in their voter participation around 2006, and they peaked in 2016. Mm-hmm. They showed back up. And what they were coming back out against was not so much for this celebrity that they might have seen on TV, but it's what he tapped into that was the sense of everything you're trying is not working. I mean, the African-American population that had been voting overwhelmingly Democratic swayed more toward Donald Trump than they had been historically toward a Republican candidate because they also said, what else do we have to lose,
sure.
right? And that is very similar to what happened here with Leave, in mm-hmm. where the status quo is not working anymore for various things. And this sense of, we want to take back power. This is an opportunity for, whether you call it sovereignty or whether you just look at it as individual liberty, self-government. That is really the wave that's been happening.
I want to talk to you a bit about Donald Trump as president.
Sure.
What are we to make of him? I mean, on the face of it, this is a man who is conducting the presidency through the medium of Twitter trolling. I mean, barely an hour seems to go past without him finding some other individual or group that he offends. Do you think he is guilty of acting in a very sort of unstatesmanlike, unpresidential, rather crass and uncouth manner for an office of that kind?
This is interesting because this is the critique, and I find it as, when you can't attack the message, attack the messenger, right? And so the point being, there's a lot that he's getting done, and he is continuing to keep this base of support. And so if we can't do anything about that, what we're going to do is just talk about he's a bad guy, and hopefully people don't like it. I played basketball. I like basketball analogies. And so what I would look at with Donald Trump and his Twitter and his commentary is an inbounds play in basketball where when you slap the ball to throw it in, one of the four players that's on court runs to the quarter and starts barking like a dog. And the whole entire defense will look at them and pay attention to them. Meanwhile, another player is wide open under the basket and he scores. And this is what's happening here. So all the Twitter conversation, everything, all the commentary that's just, the media goes nuts and starts talking about that. And what they're not talking about, they're not creating gridlock on tax policy. They're not creating gridlock on him being extremely aggressive on trade policy. They're not creating gridlock on his immigration conversation or North Korean policy, where when this had come up previously in both the Obama and the Bush administrations, the media locked things up and it got everybody in Congress stalled. So I think it's a communications tactic that he's just ahead of the game. He's playing the media.
That's an intriguing analysis of Trump. I mean, almost like a stage magician. You used a basketball analogy.
But sure.
Stage magic, you're always, the audience is looking at the irrelevant movement
right.
of the hands and the
right.
real work's sort of happening, you know, behind his back or whatever. Somebody put to me the other day, I pretty much hate everything Donald Trump says, but I pretty much love everything Donald Trump does. What's your view about the actual progress that's been made on tax and also on regulation? I mean, from a free market perspective, put aside his style, there's quite a lot to like about what's actually been done in those two areas. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it has been said time and time again. And in fact, I can give you a predictor of almost every single U.S. election if we just look at the economy. What's the economy doing? And if you look at the economy since Donald Trump was elected and then took office, the economy is in a period of expansion and growing and has a charted course moving forward that is very much along those lines. And yet at the same time, here's a guy that's going through, think about this. Here is someone that is advancing policies that are reducing taxation, that are reducing the regulatory climate, that's allowing the economy to expand, and at the same time, he still holds majority support from the labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
When has this happened in American political history, right? I mean, so what we're seeing right now is, I think, a combination of kind of playing the press and being a narrative and communications operation office at the same time that allows you to strategically continue to advance. And I'm telling you, the average Joe Q American, Susie Q American around their dinner table, that their economic outlook, issues of economic security, of opportunity for their family are continuing to improve. I think you're going to see something different happen in November than the press is talking about right here.
So you think the GOP might perform better than expectations in the midterm elections in the United States in November this year?
Yeah, in fact, in many of the districts where you see some incumbents that have tough races, what's not being reported is some of the tough races are in their primary because they're being outflanked to the right for not delivering on promises or being too slow. But it's not a scenario where a couple of these special elections that have happened that Democrats may have won one off or two off. And if you look at state elections that are happening with majority-controlled Republican legislatures and Republican governors, they're all still trending that direction. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you saw the same thing here in local elections where everyone was saying, well, the conservatives are going to lose and this is going to be tough. And not only did that not happen, but it defied expectations of all the pundits, if you will.
Sure.
That's what's going to happen as well.
So this tax cut that's been brought forward, you're suggesting, is popular and has fueled growth. Of course, President Trump said he was going to drain the swamp. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how you think that draining operation's going, but particularly in the regulatory sphere, right? Regulation and red tape just breeds and grows, it seems, in every country, America and the UK. But I think he has perhaps had some success in stemming this, even rolling it back. What's the action look like there?
When you drain the swamp, there's two things that happen, right? And the one hand, it is what is creating the swamp. It is all of this red tape, all this regulation. The other is this kind of bureaucratic social class that's there that just operates differently and operates as though they are above or outside of the law that the Susie Q and Joe Q Oklahoman, or American, I should say, have to operate under. On the former, the regulatory burden, that has definitely been draining and reducing. That's why the economy is expanding and the outlook is positive. On the latter, there's still some work to do with the bureaucratic class. And now the less regulatory burden there is, the less they have to do, but they're starting to fight back.
This does seem to be, if one's in favor of deregulation, some movement in the right direction. My researchers at the IA tell me that on average, annually, the regulatory burden and the cost of it on the American people was typically rising by an average of $12 billion every year. And 2017 was the first year where the cumulative change was negative, i.e. the cost of regulation went downwards by about $570 million. So the trajectory's changed, but I guess there's still a hell of a long way to go if it's been building up at $12 billion a year.
Yeah, the Titanic does not make a 90-degree turn.
Yep. What about on free trade? We touched on this at the beginning, the opportunities coming out of Brexit that we might have a better trading relationship with the United States of America going forward. I can't place President Trump on this more generally, though. I mean, so is he a protectionist? Is he a free trader? Is there a danger that the United States and the Republican Party are returning towards protectionism? We want tariffs on this. We want to build a wall right across the Mexican border. There's no trade war. We can't win. This sort of rhetoric is pretty nerve-wracking for those of us who consider ourselves classical free trade liberals.
Yeah, but go back to the conversation that we had earlier about Donald Trump. The narrative and the public communication that shifts attention in one way or creates reaction from the intended audience is not always exactly what his intention is. In fact, a lot of times it's a misdirection to be able to get things done privately. Most of the reports that you hear when you put them together out of the conversations that he's had in a diplomatic nature have come back from offering free trade agreements. When you hear, oh, this is what came out of the meeting and this is what was put on the table, but then you see publicly there's a lot of posturing. There's China that we're dealing with. There are other agreements that we're trying to, especially the EU and the United States have not been eye to eye, right, and probably never will be. And so there's a lot of posturing with them. And this is the way the Trump communications effort and Donald Trump himself operates in every other capacity, especially domestic policy. Well, why would we not expect that to be foreign policy?
So you're saying he's potentially a protectionist by political positioning, but a free trader in practice?
Some of this is my speculation, but again, I'm putting pieces together here. I've got to keep the labor unions happy by what I say, just like I have to keep other folks happy and paying attention and keep this mobilization together. But yet, it all comes down to economic growth and what is going to create the fastest amount of growth, right? What is going to reduce that regulatory burden? What is going to continue to expand our economy? Because at the end of the day, that's what the United States is about, and that's really how we extend our presence around the world.
And it's typically what secures a president re-election.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, more or less, if you plot a president's fortunes against the state of the US economy, it's pretty binary, isn't it? If the economy is performing well, an incumbent's likely to be re-elected badly, and the incumbent can sometimes be kicked out.
Exactly.
You've been meeting with me today, Michael, a number of our parliamentarians. We've had some private meetings in Parliament. What's your sense of the appetite amongst British politicians for actually boosting this relationship with the United States of America and attempting to get some free trade arrangement in place once we're fully out of the European Union?
Yeah, I've been quite excited that we have not met with anyone yet that's been lukewarm or cold on this. If there's been any hesitance, it has more to do with what's happening right now in Westminster than it is what needs to happen, right? So like-mindedness, enthusiasm, already talking about what next steps could look like, which anytime you're talking about action, and it's more than just posturing, that's a really good signal and a good sign for me. And my message to those MPs that we've met with has been simple. It's been, look, the United States is open for business, are you? And what do you want here? Do you want self-determination, self-governance, or do you want sovereignty? Or do you still want to find yourself in the same scenario just by a different name? You just painted the house, but the house is still the same one you live in. Those conversations have been received very well and have me excited about prospects moving forward.
There are obviously some differences between the U.S. Constitution and politics, a lot of differences compared to our Constitution.
Certainly.
I think we can tell our listeners that this afternoon you did have tea on the terrace with three English aristocrats and members of the House of Lords, and a Viscount, indeed. Did it meet with your expectations as an American visitor? That's the question I want to ask you.
Indeed. You have to understand from the United States, there is still a perspective and a desire to partner with United Kingdom that it's historical, right? It's something that's been passed down. There's something of this. It's in pop culture, right? So I was sitting there thinking today in the middle of everything else, in the middle of the conversations we were having, the fact that we were having them in that setting with those gentlemen like that and the opportunity for Oklahoma to be coming forward and to be listened to. And I mean, that's something that I'll tell my kids about.
Fantastic. Well, Mike, it's been absolutely great to have you on this podcast and to welcome you to London. I look forward to working with you closely to get this over the line in the months to come. More importantly, I look forward to the UK and the USA doing much more business together on an aggregate level, not just free marketeers working closely together. So thank you very much for being our guest. Thanks for coming to London. It's been great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. Let's throw gasoline on this fire.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.